From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Civil war in Syria, riots in Cairo, tough talk from Tel Aviv and Tehran. A big region is churning. This week at the United Nations, voices from the heart of it, Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Egypt's Mohamed Morsi weighed in yesterday. Today, Israel's Netanyahu and the Palestinians' Abbas at the podium. This hour, On Point, we are listening to a region in flux. You can join the conversation. What is the picture you see emerging from Cairo to Tehran? What's the new reality? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's the sound of change at the podium at the UN yesterday. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi with his debut speech to the United Nations, his first major address since being swept into office in the wake of the Arab Spring.
I am the first Egyptian civilian president elected democratically and freely following a great peaceful revolution hailed by the entire world.
Egypt's president laying it out for the UN General Assembly just in case they missed it. First to the UN and New York, Jay Solomon is foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He's been in the thick of things. Jay, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
So let's go to the Egyptian president first. I mean, Arab Spring, Egypt right at the heart of it. And here he is out of the Muslim Brotherhood, elected president of this country. And there's already been all kinds of action in the streets there. What was the heart of his message to the General Assembly?
His message is that Egypt was going to reclaim its kind of role as the lead diplomatic cultural power in the Arab world, that as, you know, the first elected Egyptian leader, democratically elected Egyptian in leader, he was going to recast Cairo at the center of the stage, whether it's finding a solution to the crisis in Syria or finding some way to respond to the rioting and the unrest we've had over the past couple of weeks, that Egypt was going to be a central player in that now.
So many of these speeches back-to-back this week after a period of so much change and tension, even concern about war over Iran and nuclear development there. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been a very volatile speaker at many UN meetings at this point. What about his appearance this week, Jay?
You know, his actual speech was a bit more subdued than normal. I mean, he did make his offensive remarks during the week in interviews, you know, about the Holocaust or destroying Israel, but in his actual speech it was more kind of about his desire for a changed world order and a really religious tone about the return of Shiite Islam's Messiah. It was an interesting couple of days for Ahmadinejad because it did feel like he's kind of a weakened figure, just as he was speaking, Iranian security forces arrested one of his closest media advisor, and he seemed a little bit startled when he was at a press conference yesterday, and then he actually started to criticize some of his government's own economic policies. So it was, the sense on Ahmadinejad, he's still kind of a bombastic figure, but he's a much kind of smaller player than he was, and he's exiting, you know, the presidency next June.
Challenges for Ahmadinejad at home as he addressed the world gathering in New York. Here he was with some of that talk about the current world order, he said, was rooted in slavery and colonialism.
It has been shaped according to selfishness, deception, hatred, and animosity. It believes in classification of human beings, humiliation of other nations, trampling upon the rights of others and their domination.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, outgoing president of Iran, he's had two terms that will end next summer. He's up against term limits in Iran. There, Iran at the head of the non-aligned movement now. Can you imagine him with a continuing, ongoing international role, or do you think he'll be kind of sucked back into Iranian politics and off the global stage, Jay, after next summer?
You know, he's got quite a kind of a nationalist kind of base in Iran. So it's hard to see Ahmadinejad sort of disappearing. This week he talked about returning to university, but that he definitely remained engaged in Iranian politics. It's kind of a bit hard to see how, I mean, he's not in good standing with the supreme leader, how he might sort of maintain his a role in actual government outside of politics. But who knows? He's definitely a sort of an ambitious and savvy politician, so it's kind of hard to imagine he's just going to disappear after 8 years of all this headline making.
And as we speak, of course, President Obama speaking at the UN as well this week, standing up for free speech and pushing against the kind of slurs that we saw in that online video against Islam. Mohamed Morsi, very tough on that yesterday, saying we free speech, but not when it comes to religion.
Yeah, there was definitely a tension between what President Obama laid out on Tuesday and the addresses from Morsi, Yemen's leader, which was very much, you know, focused on, you know, free peace, you know, open free speech in some ways is good, but in some ways it's also sort of a Western idea. We believe our prophet should be protected, and that, you know, it's not the right of people to criticize or to smear our religious leader. So there was definite, you know, tension between what the president was saying and then what some of the Arab or Muslim leaders were saying. Ahmadinejad even, like, subtly suggested that the fatwa in Salman Rushdie was still in play and made some sort of somewhat threatening comment. So there was definitely a tension between what Obama was saying and what some in the Islamic world were saying.
As we go to air, Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, have not yet spoken. Of course, they will today. But this open letter to Israelis from Netanyahu before marking the end of Yom Kippur as he headed toward New York, very tough on Iran.
Yeah, we're expecting he's going to sort of try to outline a bit more what his red lines are as far as what is unacceptable for Israel as far as Iran's nuclear development and, you know, the possibility of that could spark a military response. Of course, Netanyahu has been pressing Obama to do that, to set lines, and he did not do that in his speech on Tuesday, Obama. He you know, kind of reiterated his response that a nuclear-armed Iran was unacceptable, but didn't sort of say anything about what steps that could cause the U.S. to take military action ahead of that. So there's going to be a lot of interest in how Netanyahu kind of lays that out. Ahmadinejad was very clear, thinking that, you know, they didn't take the military threat very seriously from the Israelis, which is another sort of interesting element into this whole situation, because, as we know, the Iranian program continues to develop. They continue to amass more fissile material and are quite close to that kind of line between what's kind of medium-range enriched uranium to weaponized fuel. So it's a dangerous time on that score.
And President Obama, of course, interestingly this week, not meeting with any of the heads of state there in this campaign season with a new delicate balance going on in the region. Jay Solomon with The Wall Street Journal in New York. Thanks very much for being with us for a few minutes, Jay.
Thank you.
Here was the Iranian president again, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, on this nuclear front, so much in the news here and in the region, saying at the UN this week that there's a double standard on nuclear weapons in the Middle East. Ahmadinejad.
Arms race and intimidation by nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction by the hegemonic powers have become prevalent. Testing new generations of ultra-modern weaponry and a pledge to disclose these armaments on due time is now being used as a new language of threat against nations to coerce them into accepting a new era of hegemony.
The Iranian president in New York at the UN this week. We're going to hear in just a moment from Aaron David Miller and Abdelbari Atwan. With us right now from New York is Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs. Gideon, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
What's the horizon that you see, the new horizon showing itself at the UN this week? You've got Morsi there, Ahmadinejad on his way out. We all know what's blazing in the Middle East, from Syria right on through these riots we've seen after the Arab Spring and the video. What's the new profile here, Gideon?
Well, you know, it's interesting. First of all, it's interesting that the UN itself, although they're all coming here to use it as a forum and a platform, is not really the center of the action. So the fact is that nothing much that's said this week at the UN will matter all that much, and the UN will not be the forum in which key trends or developments take place. whereas the region is itself in turmoil, as you said. And what you see here is indeed the symbolism of that. So Morsi's speech, I think, was notable less for any specific content that it had than for what he himself highlighted, which is, look, I'm here as the first democratically elected civilian leader of Egypt. And in effect, it's almost a little bit like Obama being important for who he was when he got elected. So the fact that you have a moderate Muslim Brotherhood Islamist as the leader of Egypt, and he's taking part in a sort of democratic system, that in itself says volumes. And Ahmadinejad, you know, in the past, he's often used his speeches to be outrageous in various ways and make all sorts of crimes against history and so forth. As one ambassador said, one diplomat said this week, the only crime of his speech yesterday was against coherence. So I don't think it mattered that much. And, you know, anyway, frankly, I think the world and the media pays far too much attention to Ahmadinejad because he's not the one who sets major Iranian policy, particularly in things like the nuclear sphere. So it's not really clear what all his provocations amount to other than a good cabaret act.
The UN kind of sidelined in spite of the speeches here. What about the U.S., Gideon? Also sidelined here, or not the fulcrum that it long imagined itself to be in this region? Or
yes and
the
no.
key fulcrum because maybe the war?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If there was a war with Iran, yes, but with regard to the region, it is indeed on the back burner. And perhaps we could talk about that in, down the road a little bit.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about a region on edge, in flux, Morsi, Ahmadinejad, Netanyahu, Abbas, all at the UN this week. President Obama not doing a lot of meetings this week, on The View, but not talking with other heads of state much. It's campaign season, and there's a lot of delicacy in these relationships right now. But he spoke at the UN himself on Tuesday, said the U.S. still wants a diplomatic resolution to the Iranian nuclear standoff.
The Iranian government continues to prop up a dictator in Damascus and supports terrorist groups abroad. Time and again, it has failed to take the opportunity to demonstrate that its nuclear program is peaceful and to meet its obligations to the United Nations. So let me be clear. America wants to resolve this issue through diplomacy, and we believe that there is still time and space to do so. But that time is not unlimited.
The time is not unlimited. Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, joins us today from New York. From Washington, D.C., Aaron David Miller is with us, public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, served in the U.S. State Department for 24 years, advised six secretaries of state, been right in the thick of so much history there. Aaron David Miller, welcome back to One Point.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
And with us from London, Abdelbari Atwan joins us. He is editor-in-chief of the Al-Quds Al-Arabi, leading London-based Arabic newspaper. Abdelbari Atwan, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Abdel, as you look at the new region being represented this week in New York at the UN, what do you see as the fundamental change? What's the new dynamic, the new face of this region, Abdel?
The new dynamic is actually can be seen when we see the faces of a new president in the Middle East. We have elected president. We have Egypt, changes in Egypt. And President Mohamed Morsi is taking over from Hosni Mubarak. This is a huge change in our part of the world. Second, we have also Mansour Marzouki and the Yemeni president Yasser Rabbu Mansour. And those people are really elected members or elected leaders. So for the first time, the Arab world is represented not by dictators, but by elected leaders. This is one point. Second point, for the first time, we have seen Ahmadinejad very humble and talking, giving lectures as a scholar of history, scholar of economy, which he has nothing to do with both subjects, and using a very soft language vis-a-vis Israel and lecturing the whole world that about him, about the hypocrisy, about double standard, and he never used his rhetoric, which we get used to. So it seems Iran is actually expecting a war, and they would like to present themselves as a victim. So in order to win the minds and the hearts of the international community, and the best way is to use this chance of talking to a United Nation to achieve these kind of aims. So Actually, we can see changes, and we can see also changes on the United States. I believe President Obama, when he's talking about diplomacy vis-a-vis the Iranian nuclear program, it is actually a change. I don't know whether President Obama is influenced by the well-known book, which is The Art of War, by the Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu, who said the best way to win a war is to not to fight it, actually, or to avoid it. So it seems the American administration trying to stay away from the wars in the Middle East. They had enough wars. They have, you know, a war which is not winnable in Afghanistan. We had a war. They had a war in Iraq, which was a disaster. So it seems they are not going to be tempted by the Israeli methods or actually provocation to drag the American to a war in Iran, which could be extremely difficult, and it could be actually a disastrous for both the United States and Israel.
Well, we'll see. Many people with their fingers crossed on that front, but we don't know yet how that's going to turn out. But yes, that tone, that still that word diplomacy in, at the center of the president's speech there, a softer tone, Aaron David Miller from Ahmadinejad, but still earlier in the week talking with reporters, talking about elimination or Israel's eventual vanishing from this region. What's the new profile you see emerging here, Aaron David Miller?
There are a couple points I think that needs to be mm-hmm. made. Number one, in a quarter of a century, I've never seen a region with more moving parts, with more complications, and a region less amenable right now to the projection of American military and diplomatic power. We are in the midst, I would argue, and the UN General Assembly, in which very, very little happens of a substantive or consequential nature year after year, it's station identification. It's an opportunity for leaders, some of which are not even in control of their own countries, to make, to further their own agendas rhetorically, but very little diplomatically ever happens there. The important point, I think, is this, that the United States is watching a region in fundamental transition. For 50 years, we dealt with Arab leaders who were mostly authoritarian. They were either adversarials like Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, the Assads, or they were acquiescent authoritarians. Mm-hmm. The Mubaraks, the Ben Alis, the Yemeni president. And all of these leaders are either now gone or going the way of the dodo. And we are frantically trying to find our way in a Middle East in which the political space available to the United States is fundamentally shrinking. I don't think it's fair to talk about marginalization of the American rule, but if you look around, particularly for a president who began his tenure as a transformative figure, convinced that he would move forward on engagement, he would solve the Israeli-Palestinian question, he would ultimately improve America's standing in this region from a public image point of view. What you see is a man who has basically been converted from a potential transformer into a transactor. In Syria,
in President Obama, you're saying.
Yes. In Syria, he has chosen, I would argue rightly, to avoid the slippery slope of military intervention, particularly before an election. On Iran, he, in my judgment, is the not-now president. He does not want to he ran on extricating America from the two longest wars in its history. He's in the process of doing that. The last thing he needs, particularly against the broken house that we confront here at home, is another military adventure. He doesn't have a solution to Iran, but he and the mullahs clearly have a common interest in ensuring that the Israelis do not strike anytime soon. The Israeli-Palestinian issue, there is virtually no chance of a conflict-ending agreement there. And our relations with our traditional allies, our two most important ones, Egypt and Israel, have become not unmanageable. But what's clear to me is that these regional powers, the Israelis, the Egyptians, the Saudis, are tending to their own interests first and giving us much less regard and deference. In short, Tom, and I'll conclude by saying everybody in this region now says no to the United States without cost or without consequence. Karzai says no, Maliki says no, Netanyahu says no, Abbas says no, Morsi says no.
Was this historically inevitable? It can look that way. You look at the Arab Spring, long oppressed people by any measure, you know, sort of rising up.
I think inevitable or not, what we as Americans have to accept, and I'm only reporting here, I'm not arguing for a change in our policy. Our policies in this region, from our support to the State of Israel, to our military deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, to our intensive campaign on counterterrorism. After all, Barack Obama has killed four times the number of Arabs and Muslims, presumably identified as terrorists, than his predecessor ever did. So our policies in this region are not admired. They are not liked. And the Pew polls continue to show, even with the potential transformer-in-chief, Barack Obama, that America's standing in this region continues to decline. So we are in for a very rough ride in the months and in the years ahead.
Gideon Rose, clearly relations are changing with Israel. We've seen that, maybe not at bedrock, but certainly in tone. With Egypt, it may be at the bedrock. I mean, this is a move from Mubarak to Morsi is a big move by all accounts. We'll see how that turns out. Relations are changing. What about the reality on the ground in the region? How does it shift in response to less political space for the United States and all the sort of organic developments there?
Yeah, see, I'm a little less gloomy than some others about all this. I don't disagree with the picture Aaron painted or with the picture our other guest painted, but I'm not so sure that it's all a bad thing. The fact is that the order that has prevailed in the Middle East over the last few decades was decent or acceptable for the Americans, perhaps even ironically for the Israelis in some parts, but it wasn't particularly good for the local citizens of the region. And the fact that it broke down because of internal revolts at the corruption, the stagnation, the tyranny of that order is a good thing, not a bad thing in the long run of history. It makes life more difficult for the Americans and the Israelis, both of whom had come gotten used to depending on sort of complacent Arab authoritarian rulers to protect their core interests. But the fact is, history was never going to move forward with the old order, and now it has a chance to. Will there be democracy, liberalism, and everything happy and wonderful in the next few years? Almost certainly not. And it may even get worse before it gets better. But the logjam politically, socially, economically has started to break. And now what you're seeing are aftershocks and turbulence in these politics. But if you look at what happened, even with these recent riots and the recent video controversy, it's not just now about extreme Salafis attacking foreign authoritarian-backed regimes, authoritarian regimes backed by the United States. Now you have moderate Islamists in power in certain regions, and you have local disputes. The Salafis are trying to gain ground domestically against their own co-religionists in power in governments like Egypt and Libya, even Tunisia and so forth. And so I think that this is actually ultimately a healthy development. It's not easy for the United States. I agree with Aaron that it's not a good environment for the projection of American power. On the other hand, I don't see especially a particularly great need right now for the projection of American power. And I think letting the region sort of grow on its own, develop on its own with some guidance, with some help, as long as we set out clear red lines. And here the Netanyahu is correct, although I think that where he puts the red lines is in a different place than I would. But I think that, it will be a very interesting period that ultimately will yield a better Middle East, I think, than the one we were on track to beforehand.
Well, there's the big question, rough ride, better Middle East. I mean, I suppose they're not entirely mutually exclusive. Abdel Bari Atwan, I want to bring that to you. But first, let's listen to the Egyptian president himself. After all, again, after thousands of years, as he says, the first democratically elected leader of Egypt, speaking at the UN yesterday.
The Egyptian revolution that was founded on the legitimacy that I represent, before you today, was not the product of a fleeting moment or a brief uprising, nor was it the product of the winds of change of spring or autumn. Rather, This revolution and all the ones preceding it and following it in the region were triggered by a long struggle of genuine national movements that sought a life of pride and dignity for all citizens.
A long struggle and the legitimacy that I represent, the Egyptian president proudly saying before the world there. Abdul Bari Atman, I'll come to you. Let me get a caller here first. Somebody waiting to come in. Birmingham, Alabama. Sean is calling. Sean, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a comment as a member of the United States military about the marginalization of the United States and the political structure and the military restructuring in the world. I don't think we're being marginalized so much as the shift of power is going from the West to the East, the 19th and 20th century, and the old motives and techniques of political and military might are changing. So the United States is essentially just taking a step back these last couple years and trying to figure out how to deal with these things.
Is this promising? Do you think it could be a good thing, Sean? Is it threatening? How do you look at it?
I honestly don't feel threatened. I think we're the strongest of in terms of safety. I don't know if that's what you meant, but I don't think it's threatening. I think it's just change, and change is always scary. It's always something that a lot of people get worked up about, and we talk and we use words that are threatening. That, I think, can be threatening.
But you're there in the U.S. military, you're looking at it, and I hear some equanimity in your view as you look at it. I appreciate your call. Abdul Bari Atwan, what about it? A rough ride ahead or new legitimacy, chance for progress, the kind of Arab Spring optimism?
Well, actually, I do agree with Mr. Miller that it is getting worse in the beginning. It is in the transitional period, but after that it will be better. Nothing worse than a brutal dictatorship, which ruled most of the countries for the last 40 years. Now the people start actually to try to find their way toward democracy, toward prosperity in that part of the world. I wasn't surprised by President Morsi when he said he was the first elected leader of Egypt for thousands of years. Where I differ with him, it is not actually for thousands of years, because during the pharaohs, there wasn't things called democracy in that part of the world. No election at all. But he was right. He was the first elected leader. So I think the region, if we manage actually to weather the storm, I mean, you know, the Iranian situation, the Iranian nuclear program, the Israeli threats, if we manage to actually to pass through this the coming 6 months safely without any wars, I think the Middle East will be extremely prosperous and extremely different from the old Middle East, the old order, which actually dominated the Middle East for the last 40 or 50 years. So I am really optimistic about the future. Yes, it will be a bumpy ride. Yes, there will be a lot of obstacles in front of the new elected leaders. Yes, the economy is the biggest problem. But what I want to say, if we have, as I said, a safe ride, we should help the new democracy which is emerging in the Middle East, in several parts of the Middle East. It is the responsibility of the United States. I believe the United States has a role in that part, a peaceful role, not actually a military role, in order to help these democracy. Otherwise, all of us will be in trouble.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a region on edge, in flux. Morsi, Ahmadinejad, Netanyahu, Abbas, all at the UN this week. The U.S. looking at a churning Middle East and beyond. Big, big changes. Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs, is with us this hour. Aaron David Miller is with us from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, longtime diplomat in the U.S. service in this region. Abdul Bari Atwan is with us, editor-in-chief of the Al-Quds Al-Arabi, London-based Arabic newspaper. As he boarded a jet yesterday bound for New York, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu issued an open Yom Kippur letter to Israelis. In it, he promised to answer Iranian President Ahmadinejad's words in New York with tough words. Here he was on September 16th talking tough on NBC's Meet the Press.
They put their zealotry above their survival. They have suicide bombers all over the place. I wouldn't rely on their rationality. You know, since the advent of nuclear weapons, you've had countries that had access to nuclear weapons who always made a careful calculation of cost and benefit. But Iran is guided by a leadership with an unbelievable fanaticism.
Benjamin Netanyahu, their unbelievable fanaticism, him saying he sees in Iran. Aaron David Miller, 6 months or a year of kind of a rough ride, but we'll get past it and things look good in the region? Or are you talking about a rough ride that's longer than that?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. And my own analysis has been consistently and annoyingly negative. And I just want to make a couple of things clear. Number one, I'm not a declinist. I think the United States still has a tremendous role, assuming it picks its spots very carefully when and how it intervenes. And second, I'm also upbeat over the long term about the arc of change in the Arab world. I do believe that the devil's bargains we cut with the Arab authoritarians promised and brought a false stability. There's no question.
In past decades. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But just let's get some perspective here. And one other point, Tom. It took 150 years for the United States to reconcile the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution of the United States when it came to the issue of slavery and equality for African
Americans. All the way to the civil rights era, you're saying.
And we're still not there. Mm-hmm. But the difference is, and why I am very guarded in my own analysis, is that the United States had non-predatory neighbors to its north and south, the Canadians and the Mexicans, and fish, literally fish, to its east and west, what one historian mm-hmm. called our liquid assets. That detachment, that sense of distance, allowed us to unpack and reconcile the anomalies in the American political process.
What's the parallel you're drawing between that span, Declaration of Independence to civil rights? What's the parallel in the region?
Democracy is
to what?
Is tough. It's going to take a long time. But I guess my point mm-hmm. is we're not going to have 6 months of quiet and normalcy and tranquility. We're not going to have the next year and a half where matters stand still and the Arab polities who are struggling with huge economic problems, particularly Egypt, problems of accountability, transparency, gender equality. If I was a woman in the Arab world, I would truly be disheartened today, given what was promised in the Arab Spring and what the realities are going to be, particularly in a country like Egypt. So
what's so bad for women at this point?
Because I think you have a party, you have a president, even though
in
he's
Egypt,
formally
mm-hmm.
he's formally distanced himself as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Once a brother, you never really become not a brother. And this is a party that may well moderate its views over time, but its views on women, its views on Christian minorities, the anti-Semitic stuff that continues to spew out of Brotherhood organs, I'm not sure, frankly, that this is the kind of inclusiveness and broad-minded approach that is going to provide the framework within which Egypt is going to develop into the kind of inclusive democracy that maybe the standard's too high.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I don't want to shortchange the Arabs.
Yeah,
they certainly are capable of democratization.
Let me take that to Gideon Rose, if I may. The Morsi saying in an interview with the New York Times before he came, Gideon, saying, "Look, you've got your way, and we've got ours, and now I'm an elected leader here, and you are going to have to respect our way." And no, it's not yours. No, I don't go for the way women are presented or treated in the United States at Hooters, he was essentially saying. He didn't name it by name, but that kind of thing. So we're not going to have Hooters. We're going to have our own way, and you're going to have to live with it, he said.
And I in some ways respect that and agree with it. The challenge comes not so much in us determining what Egyptian laws on speech should be, but on whether they think they can apply those laws to us or rather attack our installations and so forth violently when something gets posted on the internet. So what the Egyptian free speech laws are, although it's something that I care about for the Egyptians and I care about in general for the world, is not something that is is a vital U.S. interest. Where what is a vital U.S. interest is making sure that we don't get terroristically attacked because of what happens in our free speech. But there's also, you know, these things are going to play out over a very long time rather than months, rather than weeks. And it's not about whether this government is perfect. It's about whether in the long run are the forces and trends moving towards a positive outcome better and stronger than the ones moving for a negative outcome. And I think there's a trend here that we haven't even talked about. Mm. If you look at what are the most recent things happening recently that will have a big positive effect on all this, I think that, you know, developments in the energy industry, shale gas, the reason the United States is so involved in the Middle East in the first place mm-hmm. is because partly because of Israel and largely because of the incredible energy resources throughout the region and the dependence of the global economy on
FDR
those energy resources.
FDR looked over there decades ago and said, wait a minute, we got to get close to the Saudis. They've got the oil.
The United States has become a net exporter. I mean, you now, if the revolution in energy that the natural gas finds and technologies have started recently continues, I think you're going to see in the long run a much less important strategic role for the Middle East in the world, and that will only be good for American foreign policy, and frankly, it'll ultimately be good for the Middle East as well.
Gideon, Aaron, Abdul, let me go to our listeners again. Dave in Hartford, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate today. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about Morsi's talk, the Arab Spring. I'm looking at the influence of social media and how that impacted actions recently across the world in Egypt and Libya and yeah. all of the other countries where we had unrest. And that's coinciding, of course, you know, with these addresses and call for laws that we're hearing about to you know, constrain speech in a democracy, to be able to constrain speech to you know, not offend a religious leader.
Which democracy are you referring to now, Dave? Egypt, the U.S., Yemen?
Right. I'm referring to democracies that may or may not be secular or, you know, mm-hmm. religious, liberal, or conservative. And I think because of the fact that we have this impact of social media and there's such a dynamic that is at play, that leaders actually who normally negotiate these things have to be speaking to their people in each culture to, you know, for example, here in the U.S., it's important that people understand that the U.S. Constitution has to live in the world. It doesn't rule the world. It has to live within the world.
Are you suggesting that Americans trim their free speech?
Not at all.
Uh-huh.
I'm suggesting that we become sensitive mm-hmm. and not react. We see a lot of social media. I'm very active on Twitter. We see a lot yeah. of social media knee-jerk reactions to these calls for these kinds of laws, which leads me to believe that we do not have a cultural sensitivity. And I think it's important for our leaders to help us come each to a cultural sensitivity so that it cools down the masses.
Well, that seems to be kind of what President Obama was saying, even as he staunchly defended free speech, trying to find that balance. But it's tough when one person, you know, in one bedroom can put really hot stuff up on the web and it's all over the world. Abdul Bari Atwan, we heard the president of Egypt and of Yemen both saying free speech must have its limits when it comes to religion, when it comes to insulting other cultures. President Obama saying it can't have limits. Limits are exactly what allow, you know, the powerful to get away with bad stuff. And free speech, even when it's painful, the president said, is necessary. How do we live with this in a period, Abdul, where, you know, the new media are going to push all kinds of messages all over the world in an instant?
Yes, it is extremely difficult to curb the freedom of speech, freedom of expression. It is now part of our culture, part of our needs, actually, spreading everywhere. Smart mobile phones are everywhere. But you know, we have to understand other people's sensitivities. We know I am an editor of a newspaper, Middle Eastern newspaper. I publish my newspaper from London. So I respect the laws in this country. You can actually differentiate between the freedom of speech and the freedom of insult. That's the problem here. Muslim words have their own sensitivities.
But what do we do about that? The president, Obama, said, look, I get insulted all the time, but I just live with it because that is our law. And that's the U.S. And whatever you do in the U.S. instantly is on YouTube and available in Egypt or you name it, Yemen, wherever.
Yes, but, you know, he is President Barack Obama. He is not Prophet Muhammad. He is not a prophet. He is not actually, you know, Jesus Christ, for example. So maybe, you know, he should be, you know, criticized, maybe sometimes insulted. He is a public figure. Mm. When he left his job, nobody will care about him, or very few people mm-hmm. will care about him. But Prophet Muhammad is there for 1,500 years, and he is actually considered as the most, the holiest person, you know, and for a billion and a half billion people all over the world.
If I may, Gideon Rose, how do we get around this? Now you've got democracies where people are going to be upset. Okay. Some people are going to be upset, Gideon. How do you get around this, what could be just an endless provocation?
You learn to live. There's going to be endless provocations because of free speech, and there are going to be endless sensitivities outraged in an ever more globalized, ever more liberalized world. The stability and peace of the grave and of the police backroom torture chamber mm-hmm. is what you used to have prevail, and that in some ways kept things very clean and nice and tidy, but it was not a good human reality. So we should expect lots more protests. We should expect a continuing series of outrages. And the best antidote to all of that is for adults to manage the situation properly in each local country. We should be telling the governments of these countries, the Egyptian government, the Tunisian government, the Libyan government, mm-hmm. that the answer to this is to police your own public order such that crowds cannot attack embassies or consulates with impunity, that you need to crack down on your own extremists, and in effect treat this as a question of public order, not about religion, because those conflicts are going to happen, and there are even going to be riots in the streets or protests in the streets. What matters ultimately is whether violence is allowed to prevail and public order can be maintained.
But you're saying, but if they perceive it as cultural violence toward the Prophet Muhammad, you're saying they have to live with that. And President Obama is not supposed to say, and you Americans on this side, lay off the Prophet.
The president should not be telling Americans what to say. He can and should, I think, legitimately distinguish whatever is said by individual Americans from government policy and the official position of the United States. I think it's legit to say this is not our official position. We don't have an official position, but our people get the right to say what they want.
There's going to be plenty of friction there. Jason in Lexington, Kentucky. Jason, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just got a brief question for your guests on the Iranian issue real quickly. Most of the time when we hear the issue of Iran mentioned, the analysis tends to focus on their intentions. My question is, what do you all think, what threat does the Iranian regime present in terms of actual capabilities that they possess?
Do you mean now, Jason, or do you mean down the road if they continue with their nuclear program?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean right now. What capacity do they have that makes them threatening? Has that changed, and how do you know that?
All right, we'll just ask it just as broadly as that. Aaron David Miller, what do you say?
Well, if you're talking about unconventional weapons, the Iranians are in the process of trying to develop the capacity to produce a weapon. Whether or not they choose to weaponize is another matter. And I think that in the end becomes the key issue. There's only one country in the world that could prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and that's the Iranians, should they judge that the costs of acquisition are prohibitive. You know, outside of the five permanent members of the Security Council, you have four countries that have deliverable nuclear weapons: the North Koreans, the Indians, the Pakistanis, and the Israelis. So the notion that we are going to be able to stop the Iranians should they want a weapon, I think is fanciful.
Then what is Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, talking about?
He's talking about trying to get the United States either to provide the Israelis with assurances that Obama or Mitt Romney, depending on who's elected president, will act against the Iranians, or give the Israelis the hardware.
But you're saying no one could stop it except the Iranians themselves.
That's exactly right. And that's why nobody has an answer to the question that your guest posed. No one has a solution to the conundrum that we now face. Negotiations are not producing. Can they? Maybe. Who knows? Sanctions will retard or delay, but will not prevent the Iranians from acquiring their program. Therefore, we're drifting. And the default position here, in an alarming way, appears to be the prospects, probably in 2013, not this year, of either a unilateral Israeli strike or an American strike. And that, of course, the risk-to-reward ratio there, Tom, is skewed pretty badly, it seems to me, toward the risk end of the scale.
Ahmadinejad saying they're not afraid. Iran, speaking to our caller's capacity question, he says, Iran, you know, has modern military. We're not afraid of Israel. What do you think about that, Aaron?
Oh, I think the Iranians can absorb an Israeli attack. I do not believe they want and or want to risk a full-blown military confrontation with the United States.
And here we sit, approaching the end of 2012. And then 2013 follows, and we'll see. In this whole new and changing milieu, that sits there waiting to be answered, much more waiting to be seen. Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for sharing some thoughts.
Pleasure.
Gideon Ross, editor of Foreign Affairs in New York. Gideon, thank you very much. Gideon Rose, my apologies. Thank you very much, Gideon, for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Abdel Bari Atwan with Al-Quds Al-Arabi in London. Thank you very much, Abdel.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.